Welcome to Nature Bass Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. I'm Pauline Schneider in New York, and this edition of Nature Bass Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. And as a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. The background music for a couple of our regular segments is provided by 17-year-old Scottish teenager Rianne Farragon, thanks to the both of them. Tonight I'll have as my guest Marilyn Ellie, who has been fighting for 20 years to close Indian Point, the most notorious nuclear power plant in the U.S., maybe in the world. She has some amazing information and insights to share with us. A few weeks ago, Guy asked me if I'd be interested in taking one show a month on Nature Bass Last, and I said I thought that would be a lot of fun, albeit terrifying as well. About 1,000 years ago, I actually had an FCC radio engineer's license through my school, Amarillo College in Texas, where I DJed the college's Saturday morning New Wave radio show. But I didn't do much talking because I was really shy. I'd log on to the station really early in the morning, much earlier than anyone who would actually be listening to New Wave. So, and then I'd start spinning vinyl based on the playlist I'd created. It was quite an experience. Radio has come a long way since, and a person doesn't really need any special training or an FCC license to have a podcast. However, the engineers who get this and other shows at PRN on the air, they do. And we're very grateful to the many hours that they dedicate to sharing a progressive and alternative message with the people who are hungry for something real to hear. So I'm deeply honored to be asked to be part of this program and part of this amazing and unique radio station, and I hope I do you all proud. Fellow Doomers, fear not. I won't be turning this into the NTHE Hopium Hour. I will keep to the main format of the show, but I will tweak it a bit to suit my own personal style. And if you've seen my documentary, Going Dark, you know I'm all about going out in style. And when I say going out in style, I mean doing what you love before you go extinct. So if you're wondering when we may be going extinct, you can check out the brand new Nature Bats Last YouTube channel, where Guy's first episode of his new series, Edge of Extinction, gives us about a 7-minute synopsis of the window of time for our coming extinction. Now for this week's episode of News from Beyond the Mainstream. Our first story tonight comes from the website of DesdemonaDespair.net, and the article is titled 50 Doomiest Graphs of 2014, posted by Jim on January 2nd, 2015. It opens, from charismatic megafauna to insect pollinators, 2014 was a bad year for wildlife. The London Zoological Society updated the Living Planet Index and found that during the 40 years from 1970 to 2010, more than half of vertebrate species and more than three-quarters of freshwater species met their end. Stanford biology professor Rodolfo Dierzo calls this mass extinction event the Anthropocene defaunation. In the words of the Al Tejeda Conservancy in Kenya, it's a sorry statement to the greed of the human race. The article continues, if these trends continue, and there's no reason to expect that they won't, the next 40 years we'll see almost all vertebrate species extirpated. 2014 put to rest any notion that global warming has, quote, slowed down, end quote, in recent years, with 2014 almost certainly the hottest year ever recorded. A paper by Seneviratne et al. Showed clearly a continued increase in hot extremes over land during the so-called global warming hiatus. So a great way to start out the new year is to check out the doomiest graphs of 2014 at DesdemonaDespair.net. That's spelled D-E-S-D-E-M-O-N-A Despair, D-E-S-P-A-I-R. In other related news, you may remember the People's Climate March, the March to End All Marches last September in New York City, 2 days before the disastrous UN Climate Summit that basically resulted in a bunch of so-called leaders agreeing that something must be done about global warming, but you go first. And let's just do it at least by 2050. Ideally 2020, 2030 works too, you know, it's all good. So some longtime climate change pundits in the camp of Bill McKibben and the like, they've had some ideas on what to do to help reduce CO2 emissions. For example, James Hansen and three other climate scientists in November of 2013 were so horrified by the rising Armageddon specter of global warming that they embraced nuclear power as a solution. In an open letter by Kenneth Caldera of the Carnegie Institution, Kerry Emanuel at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, James E. Hansen of Columbia University, and Tom Wigley of the National Center of Atmospheric Research and the University of Adelaide, they wrote some of the following. To those influencing environmental policy but opposed to nuclear power, as climate and energy scientists concerned with global climate change, we are writing to urge you to advocate the development and deployment of safer nuclear energy systems. We appreciate your organization's concern about global warming and your advocacy of renewable energy, but continued opposition to nuclear power threatens humanity's ability to avoid dangerous climate change. Renewables like wind and solar and biomass will certainly play roles in a future energy economy, but those energy sources cannot scale up fast enough to deliver cheap and reliable power at the scale the global economy requires. While it may be theoretically possible to stabilize the climate without nuclear power, in the real world, there is no credible path to climate stabilization that does not include a substantial role for nuclear power. Excuse me while I barf. With the planet warming and carbon dioxide emissions rising faster than ever, we cannot afford to turn away from any technology that has the potential to displace a large fraction of our carbon emissions. Much has changed since the 1970s. The time has come for a fresh approach to nuclear power in the 21st century. End of letter, if you want to call it that. Well, yeah, that was an embarrassment. But there was a 10-page rebuttal to that, to this pro-nuke single-page letter that was issued just a few months later on January 31st, 2014, by Jusen Asuka, professor at Tohoku University, Seung Joon Park, associate professor at Kwansei Gakuin University, Mutsuyoshi Nishimura, former ambassador for the United Nations climate change negotiations, and Toru Murotomi, professor at Kyoto University. They astutely point out that we have found that arguments by climate change skeptics are taking stronger root in the political forum in Japan, much more than what you may have imagined. They argue that climate change mitigation is a plot originated by the nuclear power industry to promote nuclear power. That is why we, as Japanese researchers, have emphasized the need and the potential of a universal solution to remove both the risk of nuclear power and the risk of climate change. We are very much concerned that a letter from such prominent scientists, like yourselves, advocating nuclear power generation as a climate change measure may give power to the arguments of such skeptics and eventually defeat your purpose of promoting better understanding of the need for climate change measures. End of that section of their letter. These researchers are deeply concerned that poorer countries without the necessary infrastructure and safety precautions that Japan has are planning on building nuclear plants. Like, you know, countries in Africa and areas in China. China has no regulations at all. These researchers, they cite that Japan is the poster child of preparedness, and yet Fukushima outdid them on every front. They feel the Hansen letter is irresponsible at best, dangerous at worst, because it promotes a still very dangerous technology in countries wholly unprepared for the kind of disaster Japan is still reeling from. These Japanese researchers take 10 pages to thoughtfully explain why Hansen et al. Have gone off the rails by promoting nuclear as a reasonable response to abrupt climate change. And with me today, I have someone who has dedicated more than 10 pages of her life doing that. She's actually spent 20 years to try to explain why nuclear is not the panacea it was promised to be, and instead has turned out to be a Pandora's box of horror. Do we have Marilyn on the line?
Hi, Pauline.
Hi, Marilyn. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm very good. I wanted to read your bio before we go into this because it is absolutely amazing. You're just a fascinating person.
Well,
I just wanted to be sure you were on the line, too.
I'm here. Thank you.
Excellent.
And mostly it's just showing up.
This is very true. Well, Marilyn, you've been working to close Indian Point for the last 20 years. You're the co-founder of Westchester Citizens Awareness Network and one of the original members of the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition, IPSEC, a coalition of grassroots and environmental organizations in the lower Hudson Valley. You became involved in this issue because of your concern about the unsolvable problem of high-level radioactive waste, the toxic legacy that we are passing on to untold generations. And Marilyn has also learned to watchdog the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. She has regularly attended Nuclear Regulatory Commission meetings and has seen three regional directors come and go. She has learned how to read NRC reports for what is hidden between the lines, and on occasion is the only person in the room who can attest to changes in the regulatory position because she was there at the original meeting. She firmly believes this next year is critical in determining if the reactors at Indian Point will be relicensed to operate for another 20 years or if they will be denied a new operating license. And welcome again, Marilyn. It's absolutely a pleasure to have you here on Nature Fast Last.
Well, thank you, Pauline. It's a pleasure to be here. sometimes I have to stop and think, oh my goodness, it has been that long. We've been doing this for a while now.
Yeah. Well, you and I actually met about 20 years ago when we were doing some beyond war trainings and gathering. Mm-hmm.
That training has been invaluable. I think that's what formed the basis. And I went as part of several people from Beyond War. We went to hear Helen Caldicott speak. And she, I still remember her. I remember that whole event because it was, I think it was seminal for what I did later. She sent us all out of the auditorium, and her words still ring in my ears. Everybody can do something. You know, people can do different things. And nobody can tell somebody else what you can do or what you can't do. But if you love this planet, everybody needs to do something.
Exactly. Well, she is a remarkable person and an inspiration for everyone. And if there are people out there who haven't heard of Helen Caldicott, Google her, look her up, and try to see what she's got to say. She's a brilliant person and a true inspiration for us. And you know, this has been a long fight for a lot of people, and it's sort of astonishing to me that, you know, despite Chernobyl and Three Mile Island before that, and then Vermont Yankee had fires, and so many other, you know, nuclear plants have had really serious things that, you know, we don't really hear about in the mainstream media. And now Fukushima, and there's some word about this Ukraine power plant having issues. You know, it just amazes me that there are still powerful interests that still want to put new plants out there. We're not talking about new, improved, safer. Using the same old technology and in areas
Yeah, you're right. It's technology from the last century when we really need to be looking to the future and not to the past. You know, a lot of people don't realize there is, on average, a nuclear meltdown somewhere in the world about every 2 years. We don't hear about them, and sometimes the plant will just close, and you know, if it closes in another country, we certainly don't hear about that. But there are a lot of accidents, and every single plant in this country leaks. It leaks tritium. It leaks a whole bunch of different radionuclides into the environment. And still, moneyed people still see a way to make a profit, mostly on the back of the taxpayer, because private money knows better.
Well, there's that business adage: never put your own money in the kitty. Always, you know, always make sure it's everybody else's money.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Never invest your own money. Yeah. So, and that's a very interesting thing about the leaking, that they do all leak.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do.
Into the air and the groundwater.
That's right. Into the air, into the groundwater. Indian Point. No one even knew that Indian Point was leaking until they started. Till they started some construction and found some moisture and started investigating it. And then they found, despite all assurances to the contrary, that things from the water from the spent fuel pool at Indian Point Unit 1 had been leaking. They'd taken all kinds of precautions, but nonetheless, that water escaped, and nobody knows how much or how long, and they're monitoring it. But now there is a contaminated lake under the plant, which will be a major figure a major factor when it's time to decommission. So, and it's every reactor is unique, but all of them are just expensive to build and expensive to take them apart. Electricity is just sort of a fleeting byproduct of what you get out of a nuclear power plant.
That's very true. And that's, I think a lot of people don't realize that they're, you know, they always think, oh, we've got this amazing, you know, amount of this electricity that's just, it's like all free electricity. But it's not, because it had to be mined and it had to be transported.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nothing's free. Nothing is free. There's a cost for all of our energy. That's why we need to use it so carefully and so respectfully. The uranium mining out west has just brought so much heartache and disaster to so many people, Native Americans particularly. Leona Morgan is someone that speaks on that a lot. And you will hear the nuclear industry say, oh, well, nobody's ever died of in a nuclear power plant. Well, there are, can I give you a figure?
Yeah.
Okay, there are 264,417 claims that have been found, and a lot of them are by these uranium mine workers. I mean, the government, the United States government, has paid out in disability over $11 million. $11 billion. Because
$1 billion doesn't sound like too much.
No, it's $11 billion. I misspoke.
Wow.
$11 billion. Yeah, and just because somebody is not, people have been killed with reactions by radioactivity in nuclear power plants, but just because they don't die there at the plant doesn't mean they're still not part of the whole picture when it comes to nuclear power. $11 billion is a lot of money to pay out for radiation related claims. And that's what happens. I mean, anybody can look that number. That's not me talking.
Yeah.
That's the Department of Labor talking. They keep very good records of all that.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's all preventable.
Yes, it is. It's all preventable. We don't need the uranium. We don't need the power plants. And we can do without it very nicely.
Well, that's another thing. You know, they shut Indian Point down on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, they do.
We don't seem to lose power when they do that.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
We don't lose power, and that's because of planning, and it's because of there's so many more electricity generators now, too. And, you know, people say, oh, the lights will go out. And it's not people. It's the company, Entergy, that owns the plant. They say, oh, the lights will go out, the subways won't run. But most people don't realize that as of September of last year, the New York Power Authority stopped contracting with Entergy for electricity from Indian Point. So the subways and the streetlights and the airports and all those things are not using any electricity at all because they found it cheaper and better elsewhere. And that's
wow.
Where they're buying. Yeah. The market is closing down these plants if we don't skew the market. You know, they're asking for special help after saying, oh, well, we're so competitive. But now that gas is cheaper, now that wind is cheaper, now that people are doing solar roofs, they're saying, oh, well, we need a diversity of fuels here. We can't afford to let these plants go by. We'll need them in the future. I don't think so.
Well, they have all these hidden costs as well, because first of all, it's the citizens who pay to build them.
That's right.
And we pay to maintain them. And if something goes wrong, we pay for that as well. Isn't that right? I mean, they're uninsurable, correct?
That's right. They are uninsurable. That's because of Price-Anderson. There's an act. We would have no nuclear power in this country should Price-Anderson be, that law be canceled. It was renewed a couple of years ago for a very long time to protect the nuclear industry from major claims of disaster. And it's woefully inadequate. Should something happen here and there be a terrible release of radioactive materials, radioactivity can travel as far as the wind blows, but we could have a zone around here like they have around Chernobyl and like they have around Fukushima. And while people would have to leave with their pets and their whole lives and everything else trailing behind them, you would still owe the bank mortgage for your home, even though you couldn't live in it, because you cannot get homeowner's insurance for a radiological catastrophe. You can't. And what they do with Price Anderson is they sort of share the cost between different companies in the industry, but it's a pitiful amount. It would be woefully inadequate. You can just figure that you would not be compensated. The property around here is too expensive and the amount is too small.
Talk about entitlements.
Yep. Yep. You socialize the risks and capitalize the profits, which is
exactly
what they have done. They're very good at that.
They're very clever. Well, that's another thing. I mean, isn't Indian Point operating without a license right now?
Well, you know, when you say Indian Point, a lot of people don't realize that there are actually three reactors there. Unit 1 was closed a long time ago because it wasn't safe and it wasn't profitable to make it safe. Unit 2 was supposed to be closed in September of last year. It was supposed to close September 15th, 2014. Not to close, to be its license expired.
Right.
that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And it should have been closed without a license. But, you know, there's always a way with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to wiggle a way around it. And so what they said was, well, they applied when they were supposed to, and the process is long, so they can continue to operate without a license. It's like, okay, fine, just try doing that with your car and saying you were really too busy to get down to DMV and see what the law says.
I filled out the application, you know.
Right.
I'm putting it in the mailbox now.
Right. Yeah, it's like the check is in the mail.
Right, exactly.
I'll just finish really quickly here. There's a Unit 3, too, and it is it's scheduled to its license is scheduled to expire in this year, in 2015. So those are the three reactors there.
Yeah. So its license is up this year?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of this year?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay. So we have that to look forward to. Two reactors operating without a license.
That's right. That's right.
So Entergy owns and operates Indian Point.
That's true.
They also own and operated Vermont Yankee.
Yes.
And Vermont Yankee is now closed. They're in the process of being decommissioned.
Let me tell you, there was such a party last Saturday night in Vermont, in Bradford. There was a big, big celebration. Vermont has not been purchasing electricity from Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant for the last 2 years. But to have it finally closed down and to have that danger, it's not done with, but to have that danger at least tamped down since they're not splitting atoms there anymore made people in that community feel so much better. And they're still working. They're not going back to knitting and gardening because they know they still have to watchdog the decommissioning process. And you know, there's something very else that's very interesting up there too. Entergy is paying the communities. There are three communities surrounding the plant. They're paying them $10 million over 5 years to help people find new jobs and to do some redevelopment. So when Indian Point is decommissioned, I think we should expect that, or maybe even more down here, since everything's so much more expensive in New York than it is in Vermont.
Oh, that's fantastic, because you know, we keep hearing that if they close, then all the people will lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But decommissioning a plant can take up to 60 years, as you and I heard Jasco tell us in the city a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's 60 years of people working.
Well, yes, but it's probably different people. Let me give you an example from another field. In aviation, if an airline closed, it would sort of be, you say, well, we're going to retrain the pilots, but you don't want to retrain them to be the baggage handlers at the airport or at the next airport. You know, there are some very skilled jobs, and I think that the people who are working there and the communities that have depended on the plant, like Buchanan, are the ones that need to be listened to find out what will really work for them. Because some people will lose their job. Some people will get transferred, and other people will retire. So there's a whole mix of things that have to be looked at. But my bottom line is that you cannot let 750 jobs hold 19 million people hostage to the danger of something going wrong at that plant. It just, the figures don't make sense. And it's not a job factory. It's a nuclear power plant factory that produces a profit for the stockholders. So here we are, 19 million ratepayers, and the jobs, that just seems sort of like a red flag to me. That can be dealt with. Those people have good, high-paying union jobs. They need some support. But if the local AMP goes out of business, nobody says, oh, my God, what's the manager going to do? What are the clerks going to do? You know, there are things in place to take care of that. And what do people do? You don't worry about where you're going to get your food. You go to another grocery store. Well, it's the same with electricity. If we don't get our electricity from Indian Point, which we don't use much of it anyway from around here, we'll get it from another generator, and cheaper and cleaner at that.
Right. And we can, there's a place on your electric bill where you can choose your supplier, mm-hmm. your electric supplier. So you can choose all renewable energy.
For instance,
that's what I've done. All the money I pay goes to wind power, New York wind power.
Yes. And that makes the grid, and you pay a little more. I know you do, but
marginal.
I mean that. Yes, it's marginal. It's just a little bit. I mean, it's you could certainly regard it as a down payment on trying to avoid something really critical.
Exactly.
And that makes the grid greener. I just had solar installed, so my rooftop, not so much in December and January, but overall for the whole year, my rooftop is now generating half of the kilowatt hours it takes to run the house.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
But for people who maybe can't afford that, because solar might still be out of reach of a lot of people.
But Pauline, it didn't cost me anything.
Oh, because you're doing the rental thing.
No. Well, yes, exactly. I'm not buying it. And the company owns it. The company paid for it. The company actually put a new roof on my house because
roof.
Yeah, thank you very much, solar company. We love you. Having that new roof was a big investment. That's like, I don't know. Somebody gave me an estimate of $13,000, $14,000. Because we have a large roof surface, and it's not flat, but it's not, you know, real steep either. So it would have been a big expense that we would have had down the road, and now we don't. Now we have a new roof and solar panels.
That is that's amazing. So everybody listening to that right now, you can get solar panels on your roof for free. It will help lower your electric bill. And if you have, you know, a hybrid or a plug-in car, that's the way to power that car.
That's right, because we don't use much coal at all in the New York grid.
Mm-hmm.
If you were driving an electric car out in the Midwest where they are still using a lot of coal plants, that might be a different story. You're just sort of extending the tailpipe when you do that because the electricity is still being generated and creating a lot of greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. But here, as our grid gets cleaner, you know, it really is it's a great way to power your car. And solar generated electricity is going to be a lot cheaper than gasoline pretty soon. Even though gas is really going down, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
That will be. Well, you know, you have to make the solar panels, and that is a material that has to be mined for and manufactured and shipped. So there's a cost to that as well.
Always a cost. It's just how much do you want to pay and why should we pay more than we need to?
Well, the other thing is if you're, you know, if the solar panel grid goes down, then you just have a cloudy day. But if the nuclear power goes down, the power plant goes down, you have a very bad day.
Yeah,
for a long time.
Right. 20 good years and then one very bad day, as Arnie Gunderson says. Another great resource for people to look up. Arnie Gunderson and his website, Fairwinds, which is F-A-I-R-E, Winds. He's wonderful. He's very common sense. He talks in a very, in a way that people can really understand him and puts things in perspective. So that's another good resource for people that want to find out more. But, when you're talking about the grid, the solar grid or the nuclear power grid, it's just one grid. And Westchester and New York are all together in one grid. New York State, is divided up into different sections, but we have our, I don't want to get too technical here, but we have the New York's independent operators, independent system operators who manage our grid, and they've divided New York up into sections. But it is still all one big grid, even though it's in different sections. And what a lot of people who are in favor of nuclear energy will say is, well, the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow. But, that doesn't seem to be a problem in some of the other countries, because Denmark is now getting 33% of its wind total energy for last year. 33% came from wind. And in December of this year, of last year, December 2014, it got 50% of its electricity. And you know what they're aiming for? 100%. So they've solved they call it the variability problem. And the way you solve that is just by having lots and lots and lots of it. And then baseload just becomes it actually becomes a problem. Baseload is a plant that goes like 24/7. You can't really turn it off. You can't turn down a nuclear power plant to simmer. Uh-huh. It's always at a full boil.
Right.
And that's a problem when you don't need it. That's a big problem for the grid, because you've got all this electricity and no place to put it.
Right. And then if you have a major grid outage, like they did in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Oh, Fukushima.
Then you have some big problems.
You have, and they're still having problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
They have so much radioactive water there stored in tanks, highly, highly radioactive water, that they're going to start releasing it into the Pacific Ocean.
They've already been releasing it without even... I mean, I think there was a plume that traveled all the way across. I think they were mapping it with NOAA for a while.
Oh, yeah, you could see the map. But then they were going to put in the ice wall, and that was supposed to solve the problem, and there were supposed to be no more releases, but it's not working. It's just not working. So they've said this is the government saying we're going to have to release this. It's just dreadful.
That's horrible. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely horrible. What is amazing is I was reading on Wikipedia, just glancing at some basic facts, and they said that no one has died from the radiation. I find that so hard to believe.
You mean radiation from Fukushima?
From Fukushima, the workers who were in there working on it, nobody died?
No, that's not true. They had the men who stayed there, I know that the man who was supervising and kept that from being even more of a disaster than it was he's exposed and he's dead.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Wikipedia is a wonderful source, but I'm surprised they didn't flag that as controversial or needs to be verified, because that's just not true.
No, I think it's I think that the powers that be went in and made it, fixed it.
Well, you can look at the Indian Point page, and you'll see that. I look at that page and just shake my head, because there are so many lies. Is the most accurate way to say it. And you can go back and change it. And then that Entergy has a very big PR staff, and they pay people to keep an eye out and look and do things like that. Sure, and we're just sort of volunteers, and we do it sort of catch as catch can when it comes to stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see what are some of the truths about Indian Point. It is built, now we know it's on two earthquake fault lines.
Yes.
Now, we originally thought it was just the one. Now we know it's two.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been feeling earthquakes lately,
mm-hmm.
more frequent earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly how many years old is Indian Point?
Well, Indian Point, it's 40 years old. And it was, I have all those figures. I have them right here in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Indian Point 1 was in 62. Indian Point 2 went online in 1974. And Indian Point 3 went online in 1976.
Okay.
So they're old. They're old.
Yep.
They're old technology, and they're worn out. Time to retire them.
Right. And so they're on two fault lines. They're old,
mm-hmm.
old technology. They've been leaking. They've had problems.
The reactors are in brittle.
Right. And they're causing the deaths of billions of fish every day.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a 50-mile radius that includes 21 million people. Is that
mm-hmm.
the most populated area for pretty much any nuclear plant anywhere?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We had some visitors from Fukushima come, and they were astonished at the population density around our nuclear power plant, because Fukushima was in a rural area of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at our roads, and they were equally appalled. And what they told us was, they said, the best thing we could do for them was to close Indian Point, because it was so much more dangerous in regard to location and population.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because remember Greg Jasko, he is the former chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and he mm-hmm. said at that panel at the 92nd Street Y that Fukushima was in better condition than Indian Point.
Well, you know, as chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, he was in a position to know.
Yeah.
And I certainly agree with that. You know, it's just hard. People seem to think that there is, quote, somebody watching out after all this, and somebody who's going to make sure that we're all safe. And after having followed this for nearly two decades, I really understand that that's just not true. The somebody is all of us.
Right.
And people get very busy with their lives and what they have to do and everything, and sometimes it's just really hard to raise your nose up from the grindstone of everyday work, but nobody is really looking after the benefit of the public. It's certainly not the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They're in bed with the industry. All they want to do is keep the plant running.
Yeah.
And every other plant in the country. So it
he was forced to resign.
Yes, he was.
Didn't make him resign, but they made it so awful for him. They were working on things that he didn't agree with safety wise. So he just resigned.
Yes, he was forced to resign. And Allison McFarland was his replacement, and she actually came to Indian Point, and she actually met with those of us who've been working to close the plant. A very impressive lady. She took her own notes, which I had never seen a commissioner do before. That was pretty amazing in itself. But she has written a book, co-authored it, I think, about how spent fuel pools are more dangerous than what we've been advocating for, which is to take the fuel out and put it on land in dry cast storage. And the last thing she said when she left that meeting with all of us was that, remember, I'm just one of five voices, because there are five commissioners. And
mm-hmm.
that turned out to be the case. She just left. She left it, and I certainly have not talked to her about it. We're not friends. I don't know, but my guess is that she did as much as she could. And then she wasn't going to go through what Jessica went through, and she realized that she could not make any more changes in there because of the real industry bias on the part of the commissioners. And also, I have come to see on the part of the staff. You know, they're all in the same profession. They all speak the same languages. You go to nuke speak. You go to an NRC meeting, and you can't tell who is staff and who's company because they're all part of the same club.
Wow.
They're just all part of it, and they all agree with each other, and they're engineers, a lot of them, and they feel like, well, you know, we can do anything. And engineers can, but the question is, should you? And what happens if you make a mistake? You know, hello,
exactly.
Here we are, the people that live around the plant, and our voices are not being heard. They're just not.
No, and then I wonder if the people who work at the plant are aware of what they're being exposed to.
Well, Susan, I've talked to quite a few people that live in Buchanan, and I've talked to people who work for the plant. They used to come to some of our rallies because they said, no, Entergy is safe, and they wanted their jobs, and the company tells us this, this, and this. Well, you know, these are not horrible people. There are people who are getting their information from the company. They have good-paying jobs. They want to continue to pay their mortgage, their rent, their college education for their kids. And it's very hard in a position like that to hear somebody come along and say what you're doing is a danger to people in a 500-mile radius. What you're doing at this plant could really kill a lot of people. It's, you know, there's a lot of denial that goes on there.
Yeah.
And here's what they say. I work for the plant. I wouldn't work for the plant if it was safe. Therefore, the plant is safe.
Right. Yeah.
And, right. And there's really no way that I have ever found to be able to get inside that circle. And I respect the work they do. I mean, I'm glad they're there and they're working, and they're working hard to keep us safe. I'm very happy about that part.
Mm-hmm.
But
the cognitive dissonance there that, you know,
yeah,
you're not going to get through.
That's right. And those jobs cannot hold us, the rest of us, hostage, nor can those jobs hold us, future generations, hostage as more and more high-level radioactive waste is produced at that plant.
Exactly. Exactly. And don't they have a higher rate of cancer in that area?
Well, probably, but there's never been an epidemiological study done. I've talked with doctors who say they see an inordinate amount of thyroid cancer in young children and other things that they really feel is related to extra radiation in the environment. But there's never been an epidemiological study. No one's ever been willing to pay for it. So Joe Mangano has done some work. He measures, he has the Radiation and Public Health Project. If people want to look up his work, that's very useful. There are people around doing citizens monitoring, and he's collecting that information and will be, and he publishes his results from time to time. So it's an unknown.
Right.
It's an unknown. Oh, you know, there's something else I'd like to go back for just a minute and say in regard to Fukushima. Our Nuclear Regulatory Commission had always maintained in the scenarios of things that could go wrong that if you had two, and some reactor sites have three reactors, if you had something that go wrong, nothing could ever go wrong at two at a time. That you could take all of the resources from the other two plants, and if one, you know, something terrible happened at one, you would still have all these people and equipment and everything you needed from the other two plants. And that's what Fukushima proved that was absolutely wrong, because three reactors there totally melted down, and there was no staff left, and there was nothing. They call that a black swan event. It's just the worst thing in the world that could ever happen. And our Nuclear Regulatory Commission had deliberately not planned for anything like that because they said the chance that something like that could happen was so small that we didn't need to bother with it.
That sounds like a familiar story.
It's very familiar.
Great. I'm just... Getting a flashback. I'm seeing two people on the bow of a ship, mm-hmm. and they're singing a song.
That's right.
Titanic?
as the great ship went down.
Right. Oh, my God.
Oh, and you know, there's something else from Fukushima and radiation that a lot of people don't know about either, and that's the fact that we sent the USS Reagan, a huge, big aircraft carrier, to the coast of Japan. That ship was... It was 2 miles off the coast, and I've spoken with a lot of us. We had a program with Jamie Plume and Maurice Ennis, who were sailors on that ship. They were exposed to radiation, and now there's a lawsuit pending. There are 150 soldiers that started it, more joining. Some have died already because of their exposure. They were not told that the plants had melted down. And so they had really on board that Jamie and Maurice were on deck. A lot of soldiers or a lot of sailors are not on deck, but they were part of the Signal Corps. So they were on deck a lot. And then they had a lot of the sailors scrubbing the deck down. And then the helicopter pilots that flew supplies from the ship back to shore were very exposed. And a lot of those service people are suffering greatly from the effects of excess radiation.
Oh, my goodness. And we don't hear about that.
No, we don't. They're currently involved with the U.S. government and also with TEPCO. And those two sailors were really remarkable. They did not want to blame the Navy. Mm-hmm. They said the Navy was, and they were really loyal. What they said was that, and it's true, TEPCO did not give the Navy proper advice. TEPCO is the owner of the reactors at Fukushima. And right. So the Navy was operating on incorrect advice, and that's why they were exposed. So that whole court case is working its way through the system right now, and it's just sad. It's just sad.
That's outrageous. And, you know, I wonder if TEPCO will be responsible for their medical bills.
No, they're denying any responsibility because they don't want to be responsible for the medical bills for their own people outside of a 15-mile radius.
Yeah.
People in Japan have not been able to go back. There have been a lot of suicides because people have been so depressed. They're still living in refugee places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a 12-mile radius around Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
And what I read was that it's something like $105 billion expected to be a cleanup and you know, compensation for damages. I mean, that's a small, like you were saying, that's a rural area.
Yes. And when they clean up the soil, they now have big bags of contaminated soil. And they clean up that soil, and then it rains, and more washes down from the trees and the mountains.
Yeah.
And nobody knows how to do a cleanup on this scale.
No.
Just like nobody knows how to have an evacuation plan. The Japanese practice. They have a day once a year when the whole country looks at evacuation and they plan. It did not work for Fukushima. They were stuck there. And people died because they were left behind and abandoned, and nobody knew where they were or to go back and get them. And they have first responders just like we do.
Right.
We had some of those people come over the first year after Fukushima, and it really was the stories they told were appalling, just appalling.
Ugh.
Clearwater has a video on their website. You can still see some of that if anyone's interested.
Everyone, go check out Clearwater.
And Indian Point.
Clearwater.org.
Mm-hmm.
Indian Point. Right.
Yeah.
I have an interesting scenario. You know, Guy McPherson and Michael Sliva have this show, and Guy predicts that if there's a major economic collapse, that it will result in people not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
There won't be any money.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that will affect the 400 plus nuclear power plants in the Northern Hemisphere?
Oh, wow. Hard to say. I would look just at Indian Point. That would be dreadful. Mm-hmm. As dangerous as you, as I say the plant is, and as difficult as it is for the workers, if somebody is not there taking care of it, that's just unthinkable because of the disasters that, the potential disasters it could create and would create. Yeah. That would be dreadful. That's a really difficult scenario. One of the things that we do need to do to make the plant safer is to store the fuel that has been used. The fuel actually gets a lot more toxic and deadly as it is used. It goes in, it's just mildly radioactive, if that. But when it comes out, because of the fission process, there's a lot of plutonium and americium and cesium. Cesium is really bad, as bad as plutonium, in the rods themselves, because nuclear reactions change things. And so right now they take those rods out and they put them underwater, under 40 foot of water. But the pools were never, ever, ever designed to handle all of that. They were supposed to be there for just a short while and then be moved to someplace else, but there's no place else to move them to. And my contention is that, and others too, in the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition, is that we used the electricity from those rods and from that plant, and we are responsible for them. And they need to come out of that pool and go into what they call dry cask storage, which is much safer. It's still not the safest thing to do with them, but, and the casks only last 300 years, and the rods are toxic and deadly, deadly.
Marilyn, we've got 1 minute.
Okay.
This is amazing. Can you tell people very quickly what they can do, where they can go?
Absolutely can. We have a website, IMSIC.info, and we also have, I can't believe the time went so fast, and there's also a phone number that people can call, and they can reach me. Let me give you my email address. My email address is ellie@gmail.com.
Excellent. Thank you, Marilyn, so much for coming on.
You're very welcome. And more to talk about another time, perhaps. Pauline, thank
you
for having me.
You too. Take care. Thank you. Mm-hmm. To our listeners, thank you for joining us. Please make sure to like our Facebook page. Guy and Michael will be back next Tuesday. If you missed the show, please make sure to find it in the archive, fprn.fm. And remember to rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions. Afrazin, Rion Farragon, and our engineer, Jason. You guys rock. Thanks. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last.
Gonna get you.